Looking at it. Okay. This is reflecting like good. Okay, sound check. How does this sound to the folks out there in Zoom land? That is encouraging. And folks out
Folks
there
out
in
there in
Zoom
Zoom
land,
land.
uh-oh,
Uh-oh.
turn that
Turn that
off.
off. We can hear you, but we can't see you.
Everyone needs to mute.
Yeah, so if you tilt the monitor a little bit, so the camera, so that's good. Okay. And I'd invite people on Zoom to turn your cameras on if you're comfortable doing so. You don't have to, just so I can see who's out there. So good morning, everyone here at Wall Street, out there at Brightstream Temple. I can't. Oh, there they are. I see them. And everyone else out in the cloud realm, wherever you are, near and far. Welcome to our half-day retreat on the day that we commemorate the death of the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, over 2,500 years ago. In Pali, the language that the first Buddhist texts were written down in, a couple of hundred years after the Buddha lived. He probably spoke a different, somewhat different dialect, but Pali was the first the first language that the suttas were written in. The day of the Buddha's death is called Parinirvana, which means final enlightenment, because the belief was that after countless lives as a bodhisattva, a fully realized Buddha at death steps off the karmic wheel of rebirth and enters into a permanent state of nirvana, free from all clinging and aversion, all separation of self and other, a mind of unbounded pure consciousness. This state is never really well described, as far as I know. In terms of, it can't have a location, can it? It's not up there or down there. The state of Parinirvana. So what that means is, when the Buddha was enlightened under the Bodhi tree, when he was about 30 years old, a little more, that was kind of his provisional enlightenment. Because he was still living in a world of great suffering. He was still living and interacting and dealing with complex circumstances, just as we are. So that's why his death is called his final enlightenment. And of course, the Buddha's enlightenment is what inspires us to practice. Although, I would say equally inspiring is his long life of continuous practice and teaching. And since we this month are studying Dogen, the Japanese founder of our particular stream of Zen, Dogen's text called Continuous Practice, I thought I'd look to see what Dogen says about the Buddha, the Buddha's practice. Because after Dogen's introduction, which we read the last two sessions, last Sunday and Wednesday, Dogen launches into a long list of Indian, Chinese ancestors whose practice has inspired him, examples of continuous practice. So here's what he says about the Buddhas. Great teacher Shakyamuni Buddha was engaged in continuous practice in the deep mountains from the time he was 19 years old. So that's when he left his family and his home and went to practice with different teachers of his time. At age 30, after practicing continuously, he attained the way simultaneously with all sentient beings on the great earth. So that was his experience under the Bodhi tree. Until he was in his 80s, his practice was sustained in mountains, forests, and monasteries. He did not return to the palace, his birthplace, nor did he claim any property. He wore the same robes and held the same bowls throughout his lifetime. From the time he began teaching, he was not alone, even for a day or for an hour. He did not reject offerings from humans and devas. Devas are heavenly beings. Did I misread that? He did not reject offerings. Did I say accept? Yeah, caught that. He did not reject offerings. He was patient with the criticism of people outside the way, wearing the pure robes and begging for food. The Buddha's lifetime of teaching was nothing but continuous practice. So that's how Dogen saw the Buddha's lifetime of practice. And clearly he aspired to follow that example. What I find particularly moving and inspiring about the Buddha's long life of practice, at least today, I particularly find this inspiring, is how he faced his last year or so of life, how he faced his own sickness, old age, and death. He was an old man, 80 years old, certainly old by those days' standards, which was, no doubt, even more venerable then than it is now. And the Buddha was not a god or the son of a god or even a prophet. He was a wise and compassionate man and one of the greatest spiritual teachers the world has ever seen. And he died like a man of probably dysentery or food poisoning. But he faced his death and his illness and his age with great dignity and offered it up as a teaching. Remember, for those of you who know the story well, that when the Buddha-to-be was a young man named Siddhartha Gautama, his first encounters, leaving the palace where he grew up, his first encounters with sickness, old age, and death were what set him on the path. You know, it came as a huge shock to him. You don't need me to remind you of all the ways our own culture conditions us to turn away from sickness, old age, and death. It can feel like a kind of personal affront when we come face to face with those realities. And yet our practice asks us to look deeper. So how can we practice turning towards illness, old age, and death with presence, with compassion, with patience? How can we face the impermanence of everything and everyone we love? If we look at the way the Buddha faced the last year of his life, we might learn a thing or two. So I'll give you some of that story. When the Buddha was 80 years old, after having wandered and taught for 50 years, he had just finished a retreat. In the rainy season, they would often stay in one place. And he was sitting in the sun, warming himself. and his faithful attendant, Ananda, came and started to give him a leg and foot massage. Ananda said, "This is amazing. The color of your skin is no longer clear and bright. All your limbs are flaccid and wrinkled. Your body is bent forward, and there seems a change in the sense faculties of your eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and bodily sensation." And the Buddha replied, "So it is, Ananda. So it is. The color of my skin is no longer clear and bright. All my limbs are flaccid and wrinkled. My body is bent forward, and there seems a change in the sense faculties of my eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and bodily sensation." So the Buddha had no illusions that he was aging. You know, he wasn't running off to get Botox. Some of you may have noticed some of these signs. I have. How do you feel when you notice these signs? Lately, I've noticed my skin is getting that crepey look like old women have. Like Ananda, with a kind of wonder. Like, when did this happen? Is this me? It's harder to be equanimous about my gimpy knee that is interfering with my capacity to sit zazen and go hiking. My mind goes, "Wait, I'm not quite ready for this." Can we notice these signs without denial, without judgment or aversion, with a measure of curiosity, equanimity, and even gratitude for the life we've had thus far, our body and all that it has allowed us to do, see, touch, taste, smell, hear, think, feel, and imagine? And of course, even with a gimpy knee, I can still smell, taste, touch, feel, and imagine. The Buddha knew he was aging, but he continued to do what he had done for 50 years, to travel from place to place, visiting his many followers, kings and beggars, monks and nuns, lay people. Wherever he taught the Dharma, it seems in that last year that he was making a special effort to review and remind his disciples of his core teachings. These teachings were his gift to the world. He did not hold back. He offered them freely. What is your gift to the world? Each one of us has something completely unique to offer, because no one else has this particular body mind, right? Is there something you're still holding back for all the reasons that we do, afraid of failure, or maybe we're afraid of success or judgment? What's your expression of the Dharma? And when I say that, it doesn't mean you have to go around preaching the Dharma. Better not. But the authentic expression of our particular gifts is the expression of our Dharma when we offer it to the benefit of all beings. So another thing the Buddha did in his last months was to leave words of encouragement and advice to the Sangha. At one point, he asked Ananda to summon all the monks in the area where he was staying. He gave them a long and comprehensive list of ways by which a community can prosper and not decline. Any human social organization might do well to follow his advice. Here's just a sample. Have frequent and well-attended meetings. Avoid taking pleasure in being busy, gossiping, sleeping, and socializing. Well, just a little socializing. Maintain both publicly and privately bodily, verbal, and mental acts of loving kindness. Be impartial and indiscriminate sharers with the Sangha of what is lawfully gained, even what is received in the begging bowl. Maintain the seven factors of enlightenment: mindfulness, Investigation of mental states, energy, happiness, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. We'd do all right if we followed these this advice, wouldn't we, in our human organizations? What words of encouragement would you leave to those you love? To your children, your spouse, your friends? Do you have to wait until you're on your deathbed to say these words? I said words of encouragement, and care. Let's say, let's call them those. So several months before his death, the Buddha was very sick with what sounds like a severe attack of dysentery. And I'm going to read you this passage because it's a really important one. This is a wonderful book called The Life of the Buddha. Bhikkhu Nanamoli, a Theravadan monk, gathered from all different suttas. I mean, these are directly, often direct quotes, but he puts them in sequence for the whole Buddha's life. So if you ever want to read Life of the Buddha, this is the one I'd recommend. After the Buddha had taken up residence for the rainy season, a severe sickness attacked him with violent and deadly pains. He bore them without complaint, mindful and fully aware. And then he thought, "It is not right for me to attain final nirvana without having addressed my attendants and taken leave of the Sangha. Suppose I forcibly suppress this illness by prolonging the will to live." He did so, and then the sickness abated. After he recovered from that sickness, soon after, he came out from the sick room and sat on a seat made ready at the back of the dwelling. Ananda went to him and said, "I've been used to seeing you." He doesn't say you, he says the Blessed One. Every time he says the Blessed One in the third person, but I'm simplifying it. "I have been used to seeing you in comfort and health. Indeed, with your sickness, I felt as if my body were quite rigid. I could not see straight, and my ideas were all unclear. However, I comforted myself knowing that you would not attain final nirvana without a pronouncement about the Sangha." This description of Ananda, you know, realizing that his teacher was going to die, it moves me so much. You know, it's, you know, if you've ever been with someone you love receiving a really bad diagnosis, that's how Ananda's feeling here. "Couldn't see straight. My ideas were all unclear." But the Buddha replies, "Ananda, what does the Sangha expect of me? The Dharma I have taught has no secret and public versions. There is no teacher's closed fist about good things here." "Now I am old, Ananda. My years have turned 80. Just as an old cart is made to carry on with the help of makeshifts, so too it seems to me. My body is made to carry on with the help of makeshifts. My body is only at ease when non-attention to all signs and with cessation of certain kinds of feelings, I enter upon and dwell in the signless heart deliverance." So he's saying he's only comfortable when he goes into a very deep state of meditation. "So, Ananda, each of you should make of yourself a light or a lamp, yourself and no other refuge. Each of you should make the Dharma your lamp, the Dharma and no other refuge. How do you do that? You abide contemplating the body as a body, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. You abide contemplating feelings as feelings, consciousness as consciousness, mental objects as mental objects, fully aware, mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world." So he's reviewing the basic mindfulness of the of body and mind. That's how you go forward without me. You keep practicing. Continuous practice is what he's saying to Ananda. Be a lamp. Make the Dhamma your teacher. Make the practice your lamp. The Sangha doesn't need some special pronouncement. Isn't that, you know, the Dharma, he says no closed fist here. Just take refuge in the Dharma and the practices that I have taught you. So not long after that, the Buddha was visited by Mara, the demon of temptation and doubt. Same Mara that appeared to him when he sat under the Bodhi tree so many years ago, saying, you know, Mara brought his demon armies and said, "Who do you think you are trying to sit here and become enlightened?" And what I love is this, that what I learned from this book is that Mara continued to appear to the Buddha at different times through his life. You know, the Buddha probably got a little tired, maybe got a little frustrated at squabbling monks. You know, oh my God. And Mara would show up and say, "You know, maybe you should have been going into politics after all. Followed in your father's footsteps." And so the Buddha had this way of meeting Mara. He would say, "I see you, Mara. I see you." And Mara would just kind of shrink away and slink off. So this is the last meeting with Mara that the Buddha had. And this time, and of course, you know, Mara represents our own inner voices of desire, aversion, doubt. Doubt's the big one. And the Buddha had been able to remain steadfast and see through Mara's strategies all those years. So this last time, basically, Mara urges him to just go ahead and attain final nirvana. He's saying, in effect, "You're tired. You've done enough. The Sangha will be fine. It's time for you to step off the wheel and be free." But the Buddha replies that he would not die until he deemed that the Sangha was mature and steady in their practice and ready to continue on and teach others. So he announces to Mara that he will live 3 more months and then consciously let go of his life. So he chose to continue practicing for 3 more months, which is exactly what he did. His final illness came 3 months later. It seems to have been a case of food poisoning. The Buddha and his Sangha were invited to dinner. You know, different people would host them by the son of a goldsmith named Kunda or Chunda. By Chunda. How much good food was served, including something that is translated different ways as hog's mincemeat or literally sweet pig. So there's been much scholarly debate about what this food was, whether it was pork, actual pork, or whether it was bamboo shoots that grow in places trampled by pigs, or a kind of mushroom that grows in places trampled by pigs. Imagine the scholars looking at the etymology of these words. What's important about this story is the Buddha gave instructions for it not to be served to anyone but himself. And after he became deathly ill from eating this dish, he made certain to instruct Ananda that Chunda should not be blamed for causing the death of a Buddha. I mean, imagine how you'd feel if you served, you know, food poisoned the Buddha. But rather, he should be praised for his generosity. The Buddha said that this meal received before his death was just as important as the one he received before his enlightenment 50 years before. But when I read this story, I It made me think of how strongly we are inclined to blame others for our misfortune. You know, oh, that guy didn't, you know, fed the Buddha that awful stuff. I encountered this when I used to work as a hospice counselor with bereaved families. I encountered how often, not often, but sometimes, a sort of inner torment of blame would arise. You know, the doctor that missed the diagnosis, or the wrong treatment given, or just, yeah, poor care in some way. I think, you know, when something so out of control occurs, being able to ascribe blame, whether it's other blame or self-blame, sometimes it's self-blame, right? Is a way of, even if it's retrospective, it's a way of feeling more in control. Well, you know, if he had done it differently, if I had done it differently, it makes us have a way of understanding what's beyond our understanding often. So grasping at blame can be a way of hanging on. So here's one more way that we can practice, right? We can apply mindful awareness to that mind of blame arising. And we can see causes and conditions. It doesn't mean we shouldn't see causes and conditions, but we can unhook the mind of blame. Because always the causes and conditions are deeper and more complex than we can ever see. And when we do that, we kind of loosen our grip on the control stick of our lives. We open to compassion. We open compassion to our own and others' human vulnerability and imperfection. So, in his final illness, the Buddha tried to travel further with the Sangha, but he became too weak to continue and he lay down in a grove of sala trees. And that's what's depicted here in this scroll. And that position, the lion's pose, it's called, is how the Buddha lay down in his last hours. And the location was a place called Kushinara, Kushinagara. And you can see here in this picture here is a kind of reproduction of a giant scroll that used to hang in a huge hall or pavilion at Tofukuji Temple, which is right near where Michael and I used to live in Kyoto. So we'd go every year. And this the scroll rolled up would be like this. And it would the whole building was just to hold the scroll. And they would unroll it just that once a year. And it was like 3 stories high. So and it's in color. And it is, so you can come up afterwards and take a look because all animals are gathered and the disciples and heavenly beings and bodhisattvas, everybody turned out for this momentous occasion of the Buddha leaving this world. But even then, the Buddha took further steps to prepare the Sangha. He did not neglect practical matters. There's a wonderful passage where Ananda asks him 3 questions. First, he says, during the rainy season retreat, Sangha members from different parts of the country like to come to pay respects to the Buddha and be inspired by his presence. So, what were they supposed to do if he's no longer there? And the Buddha said, they should come on pilgrimage to 4 places. The Buddha's birthplace, the place of his enlightenment, where he gave his first teaching, and where he died. And to this day, people make pilgrimage. Has anyone here? I know Flo has gone made pilgrimage to those sites. Yes, you see. And then Ananda asks, second question, how are we to treat women? Now you must keep in mind that Ananda, it was Ananda who intervened on behalf of the women who asked to join the Sangha when the Buddha initially refused. Ananda challenged the Buddha, asking, are women just as capable of enlightenment as men? And the Buddha had to admit, yes, they were. So when Ananda asks, how are we to treat women? The Buddha answers, do not see them, Ananda. Just don't look at them. But Ananda persists. And if they are seen, how should we treat them? The Buddha says, do not address them, Ananda. But Ananda is still not satisfied. I love this. Ananda knows the power of sexuality, and perhaps even more, the human need to connect, to see and be seen, to speak and be heard. So he asks, if we do not address them, how should we treat them? And the Buddha replies, mindfulness should be maintained, Ananda. Mindfulness should be maintained. Well, that's pretty good advice to this day when it comes to our human relationships. I love this passage because it shows Ananda being a teacher to his teacher, patiently insisting that he deal with this sticky question of gender and sexuality. Just saying, don't look and don't speak. It's like saying, you know, don't ask, don't tell. Not good enough. Only being mindful of body, feelings, thoughts, actions, all our conditioning is how we can conduct ourselves in respectful and caring ways when it comes to gender and sexuality. We are still working on it 2.5 millennia later. And then the third question Ananda asks is of the Buddha, how his remains should be treated. And the Buddha gives detailed instructions for the preparation and wrapping of his body, the making of a funeral pyre, and the construction of a monument where his remains can be interred so people can come and pay their respects. So how many of you have put in writing what you would like done with your remains after you die? Don't have to raise your hands. Just asking. It's so easy to put off, you know, and see that as something far in the future. Along with making a will, stating what we want done with our possessions, any wishes for our funeral, all those details. And what about a living will or representation agreement that would state your wishes for what you would want if you were unable to make your own decisions about medical treatment? Who would you want to make those decisions for you? Forethought about these questions is a great gift to those who will have to deal with all those issues after we die. As any of you know who have had to deal with the affairs of a loved one who has died. So the Buddha did not neglect the practical aspects of his impending death. Amazingly, he showed his love for his Sangha, most beautifully in the way he entrusted the practice to them. In his final illness, he said, you may think the word of the teacher is a thing of the past. Now we have no more teacher, but you should not regard it so. The Dharma and practice that I've taught you and laid down for you are your teacher after I am gone. So in the end, he called the Sangha together and asked if they had any last questions for him, and they didn't. And he declared, it is the nature of all formations to dissolve. So all phenomena are impermanent. Please continue your practice with diligence. So that those were his last words. Continuous practice. Just goes on. Continue strongly and wholeheartedly. And then he entered into progressive states of meditative concentration and died. There was a great earthquake, followed by the recitation of verses by several of his disciples, as well as various deities present. The suttas say that among those present, as you, if you look closely at the scroll, both human and deities, there were those who lamented and wept, and those who were deeply understood the truth of impermanence. So maybe you can see why this story of the Buddha's last year I have found so moving, and the ways that it gives us to consider how we might look towards the end of our own lives or those that we love, not turning away from aging, illness, not waiting to offer our particular gifts to the world, saying what we need to say to those we love and care about, taking care of practical concerns, and most fundamentally, continuing to practice moment to moment mindfulness of body sensations, perceptions, feelings, and thoughts. The world calls us to wake up with each breath, and our bodhisattva vow is to listen to those calls. Any number of our texts tell us that samsara and nirvana are a hair's breadth apart, right? Less than a hair's breadth. Samsara can turn in a moment when we let go. When we deeply trust the lamp of the Dharma within us, as the Buddha asked us to do, we are simultaneously a lamp unto ourselves and to others. And the Buddha passed that light on to us with the gift of his death. Dogen, in one of his talks to his monks, on the occasion they used to mark this very day, said, "If you say the Buddha is extinguished, you are not his disciple. If you say he is not extinguished, in other words, if you say the Buddha died, you are not his disciple. If you say he didn't die, your words do not hit the mark." Having reached this day, how do you respond? Do you want to see the Buddha's life vein? Offer incense, do your bows, and return to the Zendo. In other words, sustain your continuous practice. So that is what we will do now. We will chant the Dharma Talk closing chant, and then we'll sit. Yeah.